couple speaker. As we continue to think about sexuality, how God has created us as sexual beings, and how we experience and understand our sexuality, I know that many of you have taken advantage of other venues to interact with Dr. McMinn. I've seen some of you at the talk back on Wednesday. Some of you have spoken with Dr. McMinn in classes. Some of you were at the coffee house last night. And what I'm hearing from all of you is that we, Dr. McMinn, we appreciate the opportunity to talk with you in a more open dialogue than we typically have. We appreciate how you have challenged us, challenged our assumptions, secular and Christian, maybe I should say our misassumptions about sexuality, while at the same time holding firm to Scripture. You have encouraged us to think about sexuality in new ways, through a redemptive view of our sexual struggles, to understand our relational longings for intimacy and touch through relationship. And you've encouraged us to embrace how God has created us as sexual relational beings. We've enjoyed having you and your husband, Dr. McMinn, with us this week, and we are excited right now to hear about why what we did last night is everybody's business. Would you please join me in welcoming Dr. McMinn?
I think it's cool that y'all came back, that I haven't alienated you yet, but I thought, you know, I give you a title like that, and of course you're going to come and see what I have to say about why what you did last night is everybody's business. But the focus of this is really the second part of that, which is on community and sex and grace and truth. Thank you, Uday, and friends, by the way, for setting this up so beautifully with your music this week. I have been blessed by that as I come forward, so thank you for that. This is one of my favorite things to do, by the way, is to get to come, leave my classes at George Fox and speak on different campuses and talk to you. And really, I can be provocative if I want to be because I'm leaving. And I understand that some of the things I've said have been provocative, and I haven't even talked about communal sex yet. That should make you nervous. I want to affirm something in my conversations with you today. Everywhere I go, I do find some similarities among students. That there is a desire for you to be open and to live well. You're asking questions, not just about sexuality, but about your faith and how it means for you to have commitments and obligations to people outside yourself, your communities, ultimately the world. How are you going to live well with whatever privilege you have, the privilege of an education for one? I find you really inspiring. So if you hear that you are an apathetic generation, it is not true. I find you very inspiring. All right. Lauren Winner. My title comes from her. She has written a fantastic book that I highly recommend called Real Sex. And she has a chapter in there, probably my favorite chapter in her book, which is called Communal Sex, or Why Your Neighbor Has Any Business Asking You What You Did Last Night. It's really a good book. I recommend it. Sex is communal in that it affects the whole community. She's not the first one to be talking about this. Actually, Wendell Berry wrote an essay quite probably 15 years ago about a similar topic. Sex is communal in that it affects the whole community. It's not just a decision between two consenting adults. Sex is everybody's business because it has consequences that affect everybody. I'm going to tell you some of my stories from that, but I know that every one of you has stories like it. Broken sexuality is everybody's business. That's what we hear about more. I certainly want to talk about celebration of good sexuality is also all of our business. Mark and I have had, as a number of you have too, close family or family friends who have divorced. And when that has happened, there is a grief and a loss that a whole community of people experience that are near to them. There is a need, Mark and I feel a need to shore up our own marriage when that happens to someone who's close to us. Where it comes as quite a surprise to us, there is like we are shaken, and our own sense of stability in marriage gets shaken just because people we never expected to divorce did. Divorce doesn't just affect those who get divorced. It affects a whole community of people connected to them. Sex is everybody's business. Healthy marriages are everybody's business. I had a married friend recently who had an affair, and that really shook my sense of the world. I didn't think that my friend who was a committed Christian would do that. And there are a handful of people who are working with this friend, walking with her. The two of them have decided to stay married, both partners. And there's a lot of investment going into helping rebuild that marriage, rebuild the trust there. It's come at cost to a number of us that are around this situation. Sex becomes everybody's business, a sense of betrayal and the questioning of, wow, what does that mean in my marriage? How vulnerable am I? Some of that is actually good questioning, but sex becomes everybody's business. What that married friend chose to do was my business as her friend. And perhaps there are roles we could have played in that friend's life to have picked up cues that things were not right, and that was my business, and maybe I didn't make it my business enough. What you do is your friend's business. What they do is your business. It's kind of scary. Now, that's also in a positive sense. One of the things I've learned about you, you may not all know this, but some of you are saying that the men on this campus have a pretty comfortable relationship with each other, relatively speaking. Relatively speaking, you all can love on each other pretty comfortably. You can touch and affirm each other. I think that's fantastic. There is celebrating in that too. You come into this community and there is something about what's going on is a really healthy sharing of you are crafting some healthy patterns in your life, and that's everybody's business as well. You're obligated by your connections to your friends and your family and your community at Asbury to work toward healthy expressions of sexuality, because the health of your friends and your community is dependent on it. Now, we don't tend to think that way. Our culture is much more personal and private, and what I do is my business is much more the way that we think and talk about it. Mostly, we think of sexuality along these lines. I might say that I don't believe in cohabiting, but if they choose to do it, that's not my business. I don't believe in premarital sex, but I wouldn't do it. But if they choose to do it, who am I to say otherwise? I don't believe in abortion. I would never have one. But who am I to impose my morals on somebody else? We don't really want to have any sense that it's their business, because for the most part, we all want it to just be my business. I don't really want you snooping into my life. I don't want to invite you there. I don't want you to think you have a right to be there. Well, I'm here to suggest that actually we do have a right to be there, and we have an obligation to be there. And not just that I'm supposed to speak into your life, but you're supposed to speak into mine. And not just that you're speaking truth. And if, in fact, on this campus it's easier to speak truth, then the more important message for this campus is you need to learn to speak grace. Because part of being about each other's business is extending grace. It is speaking truth, and it is extending grace. Jesus was able to perfectly balance both of those. Most of us err on one side or the other, where it is easier for us to be truth tellers or grace givers, but we struggle with the other. One of the reasons I suppose we need a community, so that we are surrounded by both, if we as individuals are not able to actually do both. A lot of us, maybe I should speak for myself, I feel mostly uncomfortable asserting claims about what people should or shouldn't do regarding their sexuality. But let's let it be clear that our government even is about the business of everybody's sexual activity in a variety of ways. Our government is saying we will have sex education in our schools. You can craft it some, but these are things we want covered. They're saying sex education is the government's business. Sex is involved in maternal infant care. The government gets involved in that. Abortion, government has certainly been involved in that. Government is saying it's our business. Our churches used to say it was our business. They used to make sex about their business. They're more cautious now. They have less authority than they used to. That letter A for adultery, it's not worn anymore. I think that's actually a really good thing that that's not worn anymore. I'm really glad we don't stone and excommunicate people who sin sexually. Now the church is more about caring for souls and a stringent guidance of those souls. But I think the church cares very deeply and knows that the sex of its members is really the business of the church. But we have disempowered the church to do much about that, and the church knows it. So if the church gets too much into truth-telling as opposed to just grace-giving, they know that people can just up and leave the church or leave church altogether. It's not surprising that we are shy in our truth-telling. And then ultimately, if we're shy in our truth-telling, we will also be reticent in our grace-giving. It's decidedly unpopular to make claims about how other people should live, and a lot of us are just plain uncomfortable with it. I've been largely hesitant to draw many lines to judge all sexual behaviors as belonging either inside or outside some box. And those of you who were at the session last night, when questions come to me, I sometimes really want to paint a fairly broad answer to questions. There are a few, because I believe sex is everybody's business, there are a few things I'll be really bold about as a truth teller when it comes to what I think is appropriate. And just so that nothing I've said so far has been misunderstood, I want to go ahead and make those claims. First is, while I think we need to affirm beauty, I think pornography hurts everyone. And I am not at all a supporter of pornography. So affirming women as beautiful is very different than affirming pornography. Pornography hurts those who view it, the men and women who personally interact with it. It hurts all women who get objectified through it and reduced to sex organs because of it. As a Christian and as a sociologist, I can strongly argue against pornography. I can argue that scientifically, and I can argue it philosophically. Sex outside of marriage, the sanctity of sex, there's a strong biblical argument for that. Even apart from biblical arguments, marriage protects children and actually women from poverty. That was one of the interesting purposes of marriage early on, getting more recognized by the government, by the state, was as a way to protect children and women from poverty. Sex outside of marriage puts women at risk of being the sole financial provider, physical supporter for their children. Marriage is actually good. The research shows that it's good. It's actually particularly good for men who are healthier emotionally and physically than single men are. And actually, that makes a lot of sense when you think about the risk-taking of single men versus the lesser risk-taking of some married men. Married men report being more satisfied with life. They're happier than unmarried people. Married people in general are happier. Even if those unmarried people are having sex, they're not as happy as the married people. As a social scientist and as a Christian, I can argue pretty strongly for the sanctity of marriage and for sex inside of marriage. Cohabiting, I'm willing to argue that one too. It's a path that's being taken increasingly by people outside of Well, actually, I asked my students, I had asked you, how many of you know Christians who are cohabiting? Smattering of hands going up. Increasingly, that's true too. I want to come to them as a social scientist, but also as a Christian, and argue that cohabiting has far more benefits to men than it does to women. No liabilities to a man, although if he fathers a child, his state will require him and garnish his wages in order to support him. But cohabiting couples are also more likely to divorce than couples who didn't cohabit. They're less happy, especially those who don't have any wedding date in mind when they start cohabiting. I can argue as a sociologist, and I can argue as a Christian against cohabiting. There are truth-telling lines I'm willing to draw, but when it comes to points I'm less certain about, I want to nuance the way that we talk about masturbation, and I won't go into that in chapel. I know some of you are uncomfortable having a conversation about sex in a sacred place, but let me say that if sex is sacred as a holy longing, we ought to be talking about it in our sacred places. Physical touch and romantic relationships. I want to have good conversation about that, but conversation that speaks both truth. What is bad about what I'm doing here? And grace, where is the longing of what I long for this? And can I understand how I'm drawn to it and how others are struggling with me and how I can walk together in that? Homosexuality, can we talk about that in a way that says, yes, I believe and affirm that what God intended for men and women is that men and women are together in unions, but can I still speak grace into those who struggle with same-sex attraction, for whom any understanding of intimacy is outside of their experience? They are not able to be close with their own sex. They are not drawn to the other sex. Can I speak into, walk into, extend grace into that struggle? We know from the data that was shown last night that there are probably, I think somebody was figuring out there's probably 70 students on campus that struggle some with same-sex attraction. How do we extend grace as we speak truth into what they are struggling with? How do we walk alongside and live in this community that is gracious and truthful because it recognizes that sex is everybody's business? That your same-sex attraction is my burden too. I want to walk with you in it. That your problem with pornography, that's my business because I want to walk with you in it. I don't want to just have it be my business so I can beat you over the head with it. It's got to be my business because We need walking partners. We need people who will come alongside us in this journey, help us understand how come we're vulnerable to what we're vulnerable to, and say, yes, I am there too. I struggle too. Maybe not with what you're struggling with, but I struggle too. Can we walk before God together, seeking God's grace as we seek to walk with integrity? Jesus was full of grace and truth. He extended it to people he had just met, like the Samaritan woman, the woman that was caught in adultery, to Zacchaeus, and to those that he had known a long time, like Peter and Mary and Martha and John. How do we extend grace and speak truth in our communities, recognizing that what we do is each other's business because we are intrinsically connected and our health depends on each other's health? We do not live in isolation, but we live in community, so our well-being as a community is dependent on caring about and knowing about what each other is doing. That's really scary. It's a lot easier for us to just want to bear our own burden and figure it out ourselves than to risk being exposed and letting somebody else know it. Given that list that we looked at yesterday about the objectifying, this is the list of what men and women say they struggle with, and men talk about objectifying women and longing for a relationship. Both men and women say that, and fearing being alone was something women said. How do we recognize we are a community striving to live well, extending grace, and speaking truth? I want to offer you some specific examples to get us started about that. So men, let's suppose that you have a close friend who's involved in a relationship with a woman, and you can see that that relationship is hurting him. He can't see it, but you can see it. She demands. She has very unrealistic expectations for him to be spiritual giant, to be the financial provider after they get married, which is maybe on his mind, but definitely on hers, to be the romancer that's going to sweep her off of her feet, to be above any sexual temptation. He is burdened by that. You can see that there is some unhealth here. How do you speak truth to that? How do you speak truth to that friend? If you were the friend with a troubling girlfriend, what would you want from your closest friend? Would you be able to listen to a close friend extend grace to you by speaking truth to you? Would you be willing to listen? Would you be bold enough to speak? Women, imagine that you have a close friend who's told you that she's just started having sex with her boyfriend. How do you respond to that? What do you say next? What does it mean for you to speak truth to her and to extend grace to her? If you were the friend, what would you be willing to hear from your closest friend? Women, you find yourself critical of women who dress in ways that show off that they have particularly great legs and buttocks and shoulders and cleavage, great everything. How do you extend grace to them? When is the time for truth and when is the time for grace? And what does it look like if you were to try to do both of them simultaneously? All of you, knowing that there are some students with same-sex attraction on your campus, what if you have a male friend who repeatedly is telling gay jokes? Are you close enough to explore why? Maybe he fears something about homosexuality, actually. That is one of the theories about people who are most likely to be telling gay jokes, is they fear something about their own sexuality. Can you have a conversation that speaks truth and simultaneously is extending grace? These are hard situations, and most of us, most of the time, choose not to engage them or to engage them part way. I will speak truth, and I will beat you over the head. I will extend grace, and I will love you to death and never say anything about what you're doing. For the most part, we do one or the other. To be a community that believes sex is everybody's business is to practice being truth tellers and grace givers simultaneously. So several thoughts on truth. Prophets spoke truth regardless of the fallout. Nobody liked prophets. Prophets could be stoned if they were wrong. It was a thankless and risky business to be a prophet. Some of us are called to be prophets, but not very many of us. It's good to remember that, not very many of us. So in the absence of being prophets, what gives us the right to speak truth into a relationship? One of the Proverbs says, "Better harsh words from a friend than kisses from an enemy." There is a friend who sticks closer than a brother, and he tells me the truth. Friends are truth tellers, and that's an early principle. I speak truth to those I'm in friendship with, not to my mere acquaintances. I need truth tellers in my life to show me what I can't see, but they need to know me to really be able to do that well. Truth-telling isn't just, by the way, telling truth about sex. It's about telling truth about how I spend my money, about gossip that I have said or criticism I've just given, a lack of respect I've shown. It's much broader than that. Community is where we find that among our family and friends. I depend, you depend on others to show you your blind spots. We are not wise by ourselves. We easily deceive ourselves. So why is it so hard to speak truth? I think mostly we want to be liked. Truth tellers aren't very likable. We want to respect people's privacy. We're just being nice, respectful people. We want them to maintain their right to make their own decisions. We don't assume people share our convictions, and we don't really think it's our business. So partly we don't speak truth because we are in a culture that says you shouldn't do so. Back to that scenario where your friend just told you that she is the way I was telling it, but it could be a he has started having sex with his or her boyfriend or girlfriend. What might you say? I could imagine an awkward conversation, something like this. So you've just been told that, and you might say, so how do you feel about that? And she might say, I don't know. I feel good, scared, excited, maybe a little guilty, a little bit of everything, I guess. And you might say, well, what do you believe about having sex now? I mean, last year you and I both said we didn't want to have sex till we got married. And she might say, yeah, but I wasn't in love then. I think that's a little bit naive. What difference does it make if we have sex now? We're going to get married. Or if we wait till we get married. That's just a ceremony. We are in love. We are committed now. I don't mean to sound, you might say, I don't know, pious or anything, but that's what Katie said, and now she's raising Bethany by herself. Besides that, how do you reconcile having sex with what you believe God wants for you? And this would be a very awkward conversation. And she might say, I don't know. I don't want to talk about it anymore. But there is a sense that you are at least saying what you did last night. I want to be there in some way to have a conversation with you. How can I extend grace? How can I be willing to be uncomfortable? And yet at the same time affirm, oh, I love you. You're my dear friend. Can we talk about this? Can I walk with you? Can I be here with you? They won't be easy conversations. They won't magically help our friends turn away from bad or wrong choices, but they will affirm that we are a community and what we do is everybody's business. We're not supposed to live independently and make our own way in the world. Why is it hard to hear truth? Number one reason, because we're insecure people, and critical words feel like a judgment that our insecurity cannot bear. So we protect ourselves by becoming defensive. It hurts to be humble. It's uncomfortable. We want to be liked regardless of our choices. We want to be accepted. How then do we practice at being truth tellers and receivers of truth? We start by asking our friends, our good friends, to be truth tellers to us. Rather than asserting myself, I go to a friend and say, can you give me some feedback on this? Was I too critical in my comments of Sarah? And gradually, we go to our friends and we ask them to be truth tellers of us in ways that are less safe. That is the best way to start in a community, is I want to seek you out to be a truth teller to me. If this woman who is saying, this girlfriend is saying, I'm telling you I had sex, on some level she's probably saying, I do want to have a conversation with you or I wouldn't even be telling you. So can we first be vulnerable enough to extend ourselves to people, not people who will just be cheerleaders and say whatever we think they want to hear, but people who will in fact be courageous at doing our best at being truth tellers. We need to be humble as truth tellers, not necessarily certain that we're right, but willing to give our impression of a situation, being willing to prayerfully say, I'll take this to the Lord in prayer and come back to you when I have some greater sense of clarity about what to say. Several thoughts on grace. I think grace is always more appropriate when we don't have a relationship with the person that we're observing, and or truth hasn't been asked of us. Speaking truth is built on a relationship that where much has already been shared, where you've got stories and activities and joys and pains. Now, Jesus was able to speak truth to strangers. Prophets spoke truth to strangers. In our cultural climate, I would suggest we do best when we speak truth out of relationship. So we extend grace when we really don't know somebody very well. Remember that beautiful woman I talked about who walked by, whom I didn't know, and when I can say, oh, she's a beautiful woman, rather than she sure wants attention. That is an inner expression of grace to someone I don't know. And when I can say that to those around me as well, affirming her beauty, that's an extension of grace to those around me. We don't have to condemn or squash everything that threatens us, especially those things that threaten us. This isn't speaking truth, it's protecting ourselves. And sometimes I don't think we know the difference very well. We speak truth when we're really just protecting ourselves. So on grace, when we don't really know a situation, extending grace is a great way to open the door for truth later. Men knowing that women struggle with body image, don't joke about their eating disorders or eating disorders in general. Don't demean women when around other men or women. Try to understand what it's like to be told by your culture that your value depends on looking thin and sexy and young and beautiful. Can you be gracious with our obsession and hatred of our bodies? Understanding what drives it is a desire to be loved. Can you be gracious with our own sexual desires that maybe include pornography and masturbation, and we saw that in the data last night too, without thinking that we're perverted women? And women, knowing that men struggle with objectifying women, that we have power with our bodies, can we extend grace by choosing to respect men's struggle over our own right to express ourselves any way we want by the way that we dress? Can we be gracious with their struggles with pornography, which come uninvited into their lives? Can we be forgiving and not assume that they're perverted or not spiritual if they have succumbed to the temptation of pornography? Can we understand the tensions and temptations of their male sexuality, which may be different than ours? Their need to feel in control and strong and successful because the culture tells them that's what they need to do to be loved. Why is it hard to extend grace? We fear that we are condoning something that is bad, like pornography. If I extend grace to you as somebody who's used pornography, am I condoning it? No, not if I'm also a truth teller and can say this is wounding. It wounds me as a woman, it wounds you as a man, it wounds our community. But can I extend grace to you simultaneously? I'm not condoning when I extend grace in that way. Extending grace may require us to give up our anger, and some of us aren't ready to do that yet. To release our hurt, and some of us may not feel ready to do that yet either. It's hard to receive grace too because we judge ourselves and we don't believe that we're acceptable as we are, that we're loved as we are by God, and it requires humility to receive grace. It's sometimes easier to stay stuck in our guilt. Receiving grace may require us to change. To extend grace and receive grace and not change is not really to be receiving grace. So two examples quickly of how this might play out. Dating or a lack thereof on Christian campuses. Men on Christian campuses are often criticized for not taking more initiative when it comes to dating. You men ever experienced that? Not taking initiative, you get a little criticized for that? Discussions with women about why they think men don't initiate focus on men's laziness, I've heard, their refusal to accept their role as initiator, or their fear that women assume an invitation to coffee signals an interest in marriage. Now, when I talk to men about this, it's a little bit more complex than that. This is a survey responded at one Christian college. This is what a man said, and I've heard other men say the same. I wouldn't want to marry a woman from this school. Ouch. Her expectations are so high that I know I cannot measure up to them. Whether that's to be spiritual enough, a good enough provider, smart enough, fun enough, strong enough. Oh, that puts a damper on dating. Maybe it isn't laziness or fear that she wants marriage if all you want is coffee. Maybe consider this alternative. Women, perhaps especially Christian women, often hold high expectations for men. They want a man who'll be a spiritual leader, sexually above impure thoughts, desires, behaviors, to have enough of promise of success to be able to provide for them. He doubts he can measure up to her expectations. He knows or fears that she's going to be disappointed or disapproving when she learns that he's not. Disappearing into non-relational sexuality like pornography may seem like the lesser of two evils. How can we be a community that extends truth and grace into that scenario? Well, we can name the truth. Males fear they don't measure up to female expectations. Maybe one of the things that really needs to happen is females need to think about their expectations. Are they realistic? It gets reinforced when females are shocked by male struggles with sexuality, with various kinds of not measuring up. So extending grace, can she be willing to understand, for instance, the temptation for pornography, yet also be honest about the pain of it? Is it possible to hold that intention? Naming another truth are her high expectations because she fears she's going to lose something of herself in the submissive picture of marriage that she's given. She takes his name, his agenda becomes theirs, she's to follow him, she's to submit to him. So he better be worth what she's being asked to give up. We found some of that in our survey data too. It's a good argument to me for a partnership marriage. Besides that, I think it's biblical, but that's a different conversation. Can we be truthful about how our expectations and fears hinder our ability to be in relationship with each other? How we wound each other with our expectations and our fears? Can we admit to that? And I want to actually, I'll skip through my another example of that and say some concluding thoughts on grace and truth. Love casts out all fear, if we really believe that. Love casts out all fear. Jesus was not fearful. He could do this perfectly. As we learn to love well, our fears will dissipate and we'll become better at doing both of those. Can you ask yourself, what do you fear and how does that keep you from speaking truth or from being gracious, whichever it is you most struggle with? Fear keeps us from putting our sexuality and our relationships under the lordship of Christ. We don't know what might be required of us if we turn our fears over to Jesus, if we choose grace and truth over fear and a perception of control. Extending grace and truth involves thinking well about our struggles and talking through with another friend and praying about those various fears, identifying our unrealistic expectations. Becoming safe people means we're people that are willing to listen. That, yeah, we will speak truth when asked, but we are there to extend grace. Galatians 6, 1 and 2, Paul says, "My friends, if anyone is detected in a transgression, you who have received the Spirit should restore such a one in a spirit of gentleness. Take care that you yourselves are not tempted. Bear one another's burdens, and in this way you will fulfill the law of Christ." This is not just a message of truth, it's a message of grace. Are you better at speaking truth or at extending grace? How might you stretch yourself to grow in the other? How well do you hear truth or receive grace? How might you seek out that which you have a hardest time receiving? I want you to take just a minute and think about someone you might approach. I'd recommend a same-sex friend that you could ask to speak grace into your life if you have a difficult time receiving grace. Who might you ask? If you have a difficult time receiving truth, who might you ask that could speak truth into your life? How could you leave and sometime this weekend think of someone, approach someone, and ask them to speak grace or truth into your life? And if you are asked, don't be a cheerleader, but honestly come alongside. It might look like, yes, I have some struggles too. Can we come together before the grace of God and talk about, try to understand and hold each other accountable and hold each other in love? To live transformed lives, we need to see sexuality as a holy longing for relationship ultimately with God, but also a desire to support each other, to love each other, to be with each other. My prayer for you is that you will grow thirsty for grace, hungry for truth, and become a community that's willing to offer the nourishment of grace and truth, as well as the humility to receive that life-giving nourishment of grace. Let me pray for you and with you. Father, you gave us such a beautiful picture of what this looks like in Jesus, who perfectly extended grace and truth to those he interacted with along the way. He models that for us, and Lord, we would seek to be grace givers and truth tellers and also people who can receive grace and truth. May we take those risks, Lord, becoming a community that believes that our sexuality is all of our business, that our health as individuals is dependent on us being healthy as communities and working, fighting for that. Lord, these conversations this week have opened up many doors, many possible conversations. Please extend your grace through all of us as we seek to move forward in them. May your presence be deeply felt and your wisdom of the Spirit be on us as we seek to respond well. In the name of your precious Son, Jesus, amen.